compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning, and thank you once again. Over the many, many times I've said thank you for listening to the program, here's yet another time. Thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for you listening, so thank you. My number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. And we have, amazingly, we have lines open. So if you've, I hear this fairly frequently. People say, you know, I try to call your show and I can never get in because it's always a busy signal. Understandable. But this would be one of those odd, fluky times when you could get in if you called now. So if that describes you, this would be the right time to call. And you'll definitely get in. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. I don't know if you saw the video of the, I don't even know how to describe it. It's like a hurricane of fire that tore through Colorado in the last several days. 1,000 homes in Colorado have been destroyed. Very interesting article here by the National Catholic Register. This is an article about and by somebody who lived, or lives, I guess you could say, in that part of Colorado with these fires that were just whipped into a frenzy by this unbelievable wind. Here's how it was described in this article. When we arrived at our home, it was completely destroyed. All but 5 of the 55 homes in our neighborhood were destroyed. Those that were not, were completely unscathed. So Matt, just stop here for a second. You live in a neighborhood that has 55 houses. 50 of the houses, including your own house, are just burned to nothing, burned down to the foundations, except for 5 houses, and they're untouched. It kind of would make you scratch your head, wouldn't it? Those that were not completely burned were completely unscathed. Very strange. Across the street, a similar picture to the south, the same. All 3 neighborhoods gone. When we climbed down into the smoldering rubble of what had been our home, nothing was recognizable. A few pots and pans, twisted steel I-beams, disconnected from the foundation, had fallen into the ash. On our front porch, we could see the crumbled concrete of the foundation, bricks strewn about, and the beautiful designer front doors themselves melted into a twisted ball. But Mary remained. Covered by black soot on the right half of the statue's body, the Marian image was unscathed. Bricks appeared to have fallen all around. Some probably even hit the statue, but it didn't even fall over. This is the statue on the front porch. At the feet of the statue, beneath the debris, are many heart-shaped stones that I believe his wife and he collected on their different hikes, reminding us, he says, that we have consecrated our lives to Jesus through Mary and that her Immaculate Heart and his Sacred Heart will protect and sustain us through anything. The statue is a symbol amid the smoldering ruins that hours earlier had been an inferno. Mary remained, as she will in our lives, interceding for us through the darkest of times, praying for us to Jesus Christ, her Son, our Lord and Savior. It stings to look at our home, all of its contents lost. The Christmas giving we had celebrated with our sons went up in smoke, along with everything else that they and we owned. Just stop for a moment. We just came through Christmas. You had your beautiful tree and I'm sure plenty of delicious food and the presents that you spent a lot of time looking for, especially if you're the mom. I think the moms bear the lion's share of the burden when it comes to Christmas shopping. At least here at Rancho Madrid, that's the case. So consider not only the nice things in the house, and the presents that were selected with great care, and all the time that went into it, and all the effort that went into it, and within a few days, it's all gone. It's all burned up. That's what these people are experiencing. Our entire neighborhood was gone in less than a day. We did not think for a moment that we would lose our home on the far side of the Davidson Mesa, away from prairie grass. How would the fire reach our home? Large lots with manicured lawns and little ground cover to burn. How would the fire ignite that? So when the fire department told us to leave, we took almost nothing. A safe with important documents and our laptop computers were all we carried out, not even a change of clothes or a toothbrush. Seeing this when we returned was shocking and horrifying. Awareness of the loss stings mightily. But we can only feel the loss as pain because of the extraordinary magnitude of the gifts we had been given in our lives. How richly blessed we are. God did not torch our homes to teach us a lesson, but through the loss of the home, he gave us an opportunity to experience his comfort through the intercession of his mother, our Mother Mary. We had just completed a major renovation to the home 9 months earlier. It was our dream home. But all of this is temporal. We cannot take it with us. We were blessed to be together safely away and to get our cars safely out. And no one can take the faith that is rooted deeply within us, fed by signs such as this, that the Holy Family is not only with us, they're looking out for us, they love us and they care, they pray for us and they pray for the world in these dark times that we live in. I had asked for only one thing for Christmas, that the Lord would make my family holy. Maybe that starts with stripping away our possessions and becoming fully reliant on Him. If you want to be complete, Jesus said in Matthew 19:21, go and sell your possessions and give to the poor and you will have treasure in heaven, and then come follow me. So what do you think about that? I think it's, you know, incredibly painful, or I would imagine it would be incredibly painful for anybody to have to go through that. So my heart goes out to this family and all the other families throughout that area who were devastated by these strange fires with the hurricane force winds, 100-mile-an-hour winds in some cases, that just moved that fire wherever it went. So my heart goes out to them. But at the same time, yes, that image of the Blessed Virgin Mary that stood on what once was their front porch, that statue blackened on one side and completely unscathed on the other, I think it is a good reminder and a good symbol of that intercession. And just as long as we're talking about this, just remember that the prayer, Lord, please save our home so it doesn't burn up, God didn't answer that prayer in the way that the family had hoped, obviously. Lord, please spare our house. Please spare this neighborhood. Don't let the fire get to us. Don't let it burn everything down. And they did not get the answer that they were hoping for with that prayer. But always, I believe, and I think the great saints can tell us this is true, and I believe that's the tie-in with this statue. It's a reminder. Yes, everything did burn down. Yes, the unexpected, the unthinkable happened. But yet, you're still here, and I'm still with you, and it's going to be okay in the long run. Houses can be replaced. Computers, all kinds of things can be replaced. But ultimately, all that really matters is not the house or the cars or the computers or any of those things, but it's you and your relationship with the Lord. So it may well be in God's providence, his loving providence. This is what this story makes me think of, that the more painful option between what you're asking for in your prayers, Lord, please give me this. Please, please, please give me this. You know how good this is. You know how good this would be for me. Please give this to me. And God says, no, I have something better for you. And as amazing as it may be, counterintuitive, to imagine that the something better for this family involved somehow going through the difficulty of losing everything first. Now, what lies on the other side of this experience for them? Only God knows. But that's part of the journey that you're on and I'm on, where those unforeseen, unpredictable, and very painful things that in the moment you think, Lord, why did you let this happen to me? I think that the Lord is saying to us quietly, well, because I've got something. I know it's hard to imagine. Just trust me. Because I've got something even more important that I want to give you. And maybe some of these things needed to get cleared away first in order for you to be able to receive that. That's how I read that story. And we'll get it posted for you on the show Twitter feed, which is at @PMadridShow. You can access everything by going to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Just look for it in the lower right-hand column. 888-914-9149. Let's get over to Arizona now and talk to Philip. Good morning, Philip.
Good morning. My question, Patrick, is my wife and I, we practice NFT, but recently I'm not going to get too much into detail, but basically we had a diagnosis that if she was to get pregnant or it could possibly cause her to lose the baby or herself to lose her own life.
Okay.
What options do we have? Is it So can I get a vasectomy in this situation, or do I have to remain celibate? How is this going to work going forward in our marriage?
Okay. Well, it's a difficult situation to be sure, Philip, so you have my sincere empathy for the situation. I assure you of that. Number one, the answer to your question is neither option is a good option, and neither option is one that you should even contemplate. So no to the vasectomy for this reason, that it's a form of self-mutilation, and it's contrary to your openness to life, even though the medical situation for your wife exists, and we don't want to discount that in any way. Nonetheless, to mutilate your own body would be the wrong answer to this question. And another reason for that would be that to do that, to have the vasectomy, which would foreclose upon the possibility of the transmission of life. And I'm speaking in somewhat general terms, but you follow what I'm saying, right, Philip?
Right.
Uh-huh. Okay. Because, you know, this is a family show and all. So having a vasectomy means that you have foreclosed upon or blocked more or less, with finality, any possibility of the transmission of life occurring. And then the situation you wind up in then is compounded, because then you're enjoying the benefit, the pleasure of the marriage act, which is great in marriage. It's awesome. No question about it. But you're enjoying it without any responsibility. And that is the possibility that God might want to bless you with a child, you know, even though the circumstances are dire. So that would be wrong on multiple levels. So I would just put that out of your head altogether. A vasectomy is not an answer. It just makes the situation worse. The second thing is, do you have to be celibate? The answer is no. Happily so. And the reason is, I'm sure you've heard of natural family planning. During the month and using the methods of observation that you're either already aware of or you can easily become aware of with your wife when you take an NFP class, these methods of observation and what's called charting over, you know, several months of doing this, you can, with great exactitude, for most women anyway, you can determine when the ovulation period of the month takes place. Now, ovulation is, as you probably already know, this is the time of peak fertility. So with this methodology, without chemicals, without barriers, without anything that would be immoral or offensive to God or deleterious to your marriage, using this simple but very effective technique, you can determine with great exactitude when that time of the monthly cycle is present. And then if you want to bracket it with a few days or even more if necessary on either side of that to make sure that no conception takes place, you can, outside of that time period, enjoy the benefits and the pleasures of the marriage act to your heart's content. And so not only do you not have to be celibate, you also don't have to mutilate your body, or hers for that matter, and you can enjoy this blessing from God in marriage in a way that not only is responsible and looking out for your wife's health, but at the same time, recognizing that this time apart can be used to show your love for her and vice versa in other ways. And, you know, historically, couples who practice NFP for any length of time find generally that it enhances their marriage and that it brings them closer together because they see each other not so much as objects of pleasure. Not that you necessarily see your wife that way. I'm not suggesting that you do. But rather to deepen the sense that you're in this together and that the two of you, out of your mutual self-giving and love for each other, are willing to sacrifice for each other for the benefit of the happiness of your marriage. And I would say in the big picture, although it is a sacrifice, it's a small sacrifice to make. And so in the end, of course, you will still continue to be able to enjoy this aspect of marriage, but you'll do so in a way that's more guarded or more careful so that you don't wind up endangering your wife's health.
We practice NFT right now currently, but the thing is, we ended up with my daughter, which we're very blessed for, but it was like a major serious pregnancy, like it was bad. And so...
Okay. Well, in that case, then I would suggest that you need to get more assistance with the charting and observation. So that sounds to me as though something was missing in the observation or something was missing in the charting, or maybe the cycle was irregular enough, in which case you would need more time to properly chart to get a handle on, okay, when exactly is the period of ovulation And when you know that, then everything that I just said, you know, should work fine for you. But if it means you have to be extra cautious, then be extra cautious. But don't do something sinful to try to fix this issue, because it will just make this issue more difficult, if that makes sense. You see what I'm saying, Philip?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, you've got my prayers, that's for sure. And I hope that the doctors are wrong. I hope that the next time there is a pregnancy, if God should bless you with another child, I hope it turns out that everything goes smoothly. I have heard, in fact, known people personally for whom that's been the case. My own mother, for example, back in the day, before me, she had a miscarriage. Her first child died in miscarriage. And she was told by the doctors with absolute certainty, you are not going to get pregnant again. And if you do, you're probably going to die. And the baby's going to die and you're going to die. And guess who came bebopping along, you know, 10 months later? So I know, I know from experience, sometimes the doctors are incorrect. God bless them. Thank you, Philip. I appreciate the phone call. Let's take a break. We'll come back to your phone calls. The number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Call me. I'm here for you. You need a second opinion? Give me a call, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. You have a special place in God's plan for the world. Learning about Christ's role in history can change your life and strengthen your faith. Right now, get free access to Christendom College's online history class at principalsclasses.com/Madrid.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
All right, let's get this roadshow back on the road. Let's go to Michigan now. You know what? No, we'll come to Michigan in a minute. We're not quite ready yet. Let's go to Menominee Falls, Wisconsin, and talk to Leslie. Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I have a question, and I'd love for your response on how to handle this. Okay. My brother has twin 17-year-old girls. One has decided that she is transgender. And as a 17-year-old, my brother has allowed her to go on hormones. I sent my brother a copy of the book Irreversible Damage.
Mm-hmm.
And it was for my brother, but not realizing the response I would get from my niece.
Mm-hmm.
So my purpose of my call to you is, how do I respond to her? My sister-in-law has reached out to me and said that I need to respond to her by calling her by her pronoun that she prefers.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to respond to her, my sister-in-law. I need to respond to my niece. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to figure out how to develop a relationship going forward.
Well,
your thoughts?
My standard response doesn't change, and that is that you're doing the young woman no favors by playing into her delusion. And her parents are actually harming her by playing into her delusion. They're enabling a delusion. And rather than getting her help. Yeah. So if it were me, I mean, I've never been in this situation personally, but you know, I've got a large enough family, and the world being what it is, that I wouldn't be surprised if at some point along the way, somebody somewhere in my extended family may, you know, go down this road, and I will be faced with the situation you're facing right now. Now, it hasn't happened to me yet, but I do believe that
right.
I would do what I'm advising you to do is to say to your sister or sister-in-law, you know, I don't have to do anything. I don't have to use incorrect pronouns. You're not dictating to me what I can and cannot do. I'm going to speak the truth, and the truth is that your daughter is a woman, not a man. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, if that's the road you want to go down, okay, I don't think it's the right road. I'm not here to judge you, but, you know, you don't get to make the rules for what I can and can't do. And if that's the price of our having a relationship, well, you've set the price, not me. You've shut the door, not me. And if that's how it has to be, it'll be sad, but it's certainly not something I'm choosing to do. So here's why I'm saying it this way, Leslie, is because the dynamic always pivots on the assumption that you are the one who's wrong. You are the hater. You are the, you know, what is it? What's the term now? Transphobe. You are the one who is intolerant. You are the one who is anti-diversity. You are the one who is small-minded and unaccepting of other people's opinions, when exactly the opposite is what is happening to you. So just don't accept the narrative, and don't respond as if that narrative were true, because it's not true. My advice would be loving, be compassionate, as we always should be, but don't play into the delusion. And let her know, listen, I love you. I love your daughter. I hope we can have a long and happy relationship. But if you choose not to do that because of, you know, the decisions you're making, that's on you. That's not my fault. And you're going to have to live with your own decisions. And I wish you well. But, you know, I would approach it that way, because otherwise, very, very quickly, certainly in their minds, it probably already is the case, but it could even lead to the point where you're thinking that maybe you're the one who's in the wrong. So don't let yourself get put on the defensive that way, because it's unjust and it's not real that you're the oppressor. You're just standing up for what's right and true, even if they don't want to hear it.
So there, my sister-in-law's comments were to me that by not accepting her and her pronouns as a him, that I am encouraging her to go down the path of suicide, because it is so touchy, you know, to not accept the child as they feel they are.
Mm-hmm. I'd say that's false. And by you, no, so she's your sister or sister-in-law? I forgot which.
Well, it's my niece, but both my
niece. No, I'm talking about the one.
Him. Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm talking about her mother.
It's my sister-in-law.
Got it.
Yeah,
okay.
My sister-in-law.
So I would just turn that around. And I would say, by you refusing to accept me how I am and deal with me the way I am and for what I think, you are setting me up for rejection and who knows what else. You see, she's trying to make you the bad guy. She's trying to say, well, if my daughter ever commits suicide, it's your fault because you didn't use the right pronouns.
Right.
So you have to nip that in the bud at the very beginning. You have to reject that premise because it's false. You have to explain to her, you know, look, this lifestyle that she's chosen is fraught with many people who ultimately wind up committing suicide. And although I don't have statistics and sources in front of me, if you look at the book Irreversible Damage, she has the statistics there. Abigail Schreier, the author. Also, Ryan Anderson in his book, When Harry Became Sally, the same kind of statistics are present to show that the incidence and the rate of suicide is far higher among those who go down this road. So it's the choosing to do this that leads them into that precarious and vulnerable situation where they're more likely to commit suicide, God forbid. You, as the aunt, the relative, who choose not to play into the delusion, you are in no way responsible for anything bad that should happen. It's her decision, not to mention her parents' foolishness, you know, that is enabling her to go down this road rather than speak the truth to her. And you have to emphasize that right up front. Don't even for a moment accept that false narrative, and let her know that this is false and what you're saying is false, and I am not at fault for anything. And you, by the way, sister-in-law, you are being hugely intolerant and very judgmental. Let her know that.
I'm taking notes.
Yeah. And I hope I don't come across as sounding gruff, and maybe it's just my voice, I'm getting over a cold, but this is one of those things where the way in which you do it has, it may be even more important than what you do, and that is you have to just draw a boundary and say, I will not allow you to dictate unreality to me. I live in reality. If you choose not to live in reality, okay, that's your thing, but don't blame me for it.
Okay. Patrick, thank you for your dose of Patrick medicine on how to deal with this. I really do appreciate
you. Thank you so much. I realize it's probably going to be hard. It probably will be painful. And I'm sorry about that. It's such a shame that these things happen. But you know, this is a cross that the Lord is allowing you to carry for a while. And maybe it will be for the sanctification of that family in the end.
Very good. I hope so.
All right. Yeah, me too.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks. Hang in there, Leslie. 888-914-9149. Let's go to John in Jordan, Minnesota. I bet it's cold. Is it snowy yet in Jordan, Minnesota, John?
It is cold, and I'm stuck in the hospital here.
Uh-oh.
Anyways, I'm calling about my sister. She worked Catholic. When she got married, she joined the Protestant faith.
Okay.
Now, I had heard that, you know, that you are judged differently if you go to a different faith. Is that true?
Well, I think maybe what you're saying, you're being very genteel about it, so I'll say it in a more blunt way, that leaving the Catholic Church is a mortal sin. And if you die in the state of mortal sin, unrepentant, you will go to hell. You won't go to heaven. Now, to what extent is somebody formally guilty or culpable of this serious, grave sin? Only God knows for sure. And it could be that although, objectively speaking, the sin is grave, it is damnable unto itself, nonetheless, God may have mercy on certain people because of ignorance or fear or compulsion or some other lack of freedom that might have affected their decision-making that led to them leaving the Catholic Church. Any of those things are possible, but only God ultimately knows. So we trust and we hope in God's mercy, but at the same time, we still have to speak the truth in love and say that leaving the church is a serious sin. And if you die in the state of serious sin, you will go to hell. And if you need some backup on this, John, the Second Vatican Council emphasized this teaching in black and white in section 14 of the Dogmatic Constitution on the Church. It's called Lumen Gentium. And if you go to section 14, if you have a smartphone, you can look it up on your phone or read it for yourself in moments. But it specifically says that anyone, and I'm paraphrasing here, who knows that the Catholic Church is necessary for salvation and refuses to either remain in it or enter into it, and I probably have that backwards, either enter into it or remain in it, could not be saved. So that not only means that people who recognize the Catholic Church is the Church of Jesus Christ and refuse to enter it, that they cannot be saved, but it also extends to those who are Catholics and then they wind up leaving the church. So not to put too fine a point on it, but that's another place you can go to get the specifics. Does that get to the heart of your question?
Well, I want you to be serious about it, you know, and right up front. And then my second question is going to be a little trickier. About 10 years ago, I did these prayers from St. Bridget of Sweden, and they had promises with them. Mm-hmm. And now I'm finding out that maybe these promises are not accepted by the church, or some of them. And I'm wondering I looked all over. What promises are they talking about?
Right.
I mean,
well,
not accepted.
I'm guessing that you probably used a little paperback book with a blue cover called Pietà.
Yes, I did.
Okay. So let me tell you, that's a good book as far as it goes, and it's a treasury of prayers and devotions, and so I don't criticize it at all for that. But some pious folklore has entered into that, and it says that if you pray forget now if it's called a litany or a specific title for it. I mean, I've seen it 101 times, but in any case, if you pray these prayers of St. Bridget of Sweden, that certain promises will attach to that, guaranteed. Well, the church doesn't teach that. It never has taught that. So that's a pious notion that somebody picked up along the way, and it made its way into that booklet.
Okay. Well, that's a bummer.
Yeah. I'll give you another example, which may come as a surprise to many people. The Carmelite order not only has no record of any instance in which the Lord or Our Lady said that if you wear the brown scapular of Our Lady of Mount Carmel, that you will be released from purgatory on the Saturday after your death. Not only is there no record of that ever having been the case, but also the church, the Vatican, has actually admonished the Carmelites over the years, you know, just stop saying that. Don't put that on your literature because it's not true. But it has become true in the minds, you know, true, quote unquote, in the minds of countless Catholics who read it in a book like the Pietà or in some other source, and they imbibed this pious notion that would be really nice if it were true, but it's not true. And many Catholics don't realize that.
Okay. I think I just lost you.
No, I'm here.
No, I didn't.
So tell me, I mean, if it's not too personal, are you in the hospital with COVID, God forbid, or what's going on?
I am. I've been here, this is my third week, and I've made really great strides.
Oh, good.
You know, but I had underlying conditions and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And now my lungs are healing. I'm doing good. I tell you what, you know, it was a conversion, a religious conversion experience for me. You know, I realized what my spiritual life really was. Well, I would say, you know, when I'm at the supper, I would make the sign of Christ, do the prayers. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody saw me pray, but then I said, well, this is me. I'm doing this, but now I realize it's not me. You know, and it should never be about me. Mm-hmm. And so I changed that.
That's good.
And so it made such a big difference in my religious life. It's all about God now.
Has the priest been able to come visit you and bring you Holy Communion?
He did. He did. Actually, the first day, because I was anxious. You know, I did that. You know, St. Padre Pio says, pray, hope, and don't worry.
Yeah.
Well, I worried. You know, and
you're in good company.
He came up and, you know, heard my confession. You know, so he even gave me a apostolic blessing. That is so cool. You know, it just made my day, and it's got me through it. And my wife's been with me from day one.
God bless her.
She comes up here every day.
Have they given you a sense of when they think you may be able to go home?
Not really.
Okay.
You know, it's just day by day. In fact, he's telling me to put my mask on me because my oxygen is going down.
Uh-oh. Well, do what they tell you, obviously.
Okay.
Do what they tell you.
Well, I'm doing good. And, you know, I'm not worried about me. I feel like I'm going to make it and go home. So,
well, I hope God has more time in store for you here. But even if he doesn't, John, you don't sound like you're near death's door at all. But even if he doesn't, when you get there, please pray for me and everybody else here at Relevant Radio and all of our listeners.
Well, I will do that.
Okay. But let's wait a while, okay? Take your time. I need you for a long time to come.
Well, I've been listening. I think you're great. I've learned a lot from this, so
God
I appreciate
you.
That.
Thank you, John. All glory to God, right? Well, we'll pray for you, John, and I will ask Drew Mariani to include you in his list of petitions this afternoon during the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. So I hope you can feel that prayer power coming your way.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, John. Awesome. You know, just a thought. I mean, you heard what John said. Sometimes, well, we talked about the family whose house burned down just half an hour ago, right? And that's not something that they ever wanted to happen. But God showed them he was giving them something really good as a result of that. Or as the old saying goes, every dark cloud has a silver lining, if you know where to look for it. Look at John. Nobody wants to get struck down with an illness, especially not an illness that could take your life. Nobody wants that. And yet, look how it worked to his benefit, spiritually speaking. Maybe, you know, maybe that's the gift that God wanted to give John. And in his infinite wisdom, he knew that it would be the best and most effective time for him to give John this gift of a renewal of his faith when he found himself in the hospital facing the possibility of leaving this world. That's how God works so often. That's been my experience, that's for sure. All right, break time. Let's take a quick time out. We'll come back. We had a line that just opened up. Say a prayer for John, if you would, please. My number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. There's a line open right now. Grab it, and it's yours. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester. That extra vehicle of yours, the one you're trying to sell, you could always donate it. Proceeds bring you more of your favorite Relevant Radio programs. It's easy. Just call 888-906-9069.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Okay, back to the phones in just a minute. First, I want to share with you an article from the New York Post. Headline, China's artificial intelligence attorney claims to prosecute crimes with 97% accuracy. Scientists in China have programmed artificial intelligence to identify crimes and press charges with 97% accuracy, they claim. Research, and I don't doubt them, quite honestly. I'll get to that in a minute. Researchers developed a tool that can assess cases and suggest criminal sentences based on verbal description, based on a reported 1,000 traits sourced from some of 17,000 real-life cases that were taken from 2015 to 2020, this according to the South China Morning Post. This artificial intelligence has already been tested by China's largest district prosecution office, the Shanghai People's Procuratorate, and proved especially well-versed in China's most common criminal acts, such as gambling, reckless driving, theft, and fraud. They hope it will soon come to recognize more complex cases. Professor Shi Yang, who led the study, said in a statement, "The system can replace prosecutors in the decision-making process to a certain extent." The article goes on, "The use of artificial intelligence in law enforcement has long been criticized by political activists and engineers alike, who argue that the existing technology isn't always nuanced enough to do justice, a field that humans themselves have yet to master. Multiple studies have shown artificial intelligence's failure to detect hate speech online or preference for white faces on the screen." That's so terrible. Despite its apparent weakness, machine learning is already being applied in court. Earlier this year, an Associated Press investigation followed an Oklahoma man charged with killing a neighbor based on an obscured surveillance video and a proprietary algorithm called Shot Spotter that analyzed noises in the footage to determine that William shot and killed a man. Shot Spotter technology is currently used in about 110 American cities, costs about $100,000 per square mile of coverage. Yet one study in April found that law enforcement isn't likely getting what they paid for. One researcher said, the technology does not reduce firearm violence in the long term, and the implementation of the technology does not lead to increased murder or weapons-related arrests. Well, this is a bit of an apples and oranges kind of thing, because ShotSpotter, it's designed to tell you where a shot came from. So it records the shot sound, and then it can, using the algorithms and whatnot, it can figure out, well, where did the shot come from? That's different from an artificial intelligence judge or attorney, in this case, in China, judging people to be correct with 97, or to be guilty with 97% accuracy. So my point of view on this story is, number one, I don't doubt that this kind of technology exists. But of course, how you program the artificial intelligence will determine what it will do. So garbage in, garbage out. So if you program the algorithms, or you write them in such a way that they're going to be strict or stringent, they will be strict and stringent. But my second takeaway from this article, my second point of view is this. I don't trust anything electronic from China, especially if it can connect to the internet. I don't trust it. I'll give you an example. My wife and I were discussing, I don't know, weeks ago, a couple of months ago, about how it might come in handy to have a little label maker. The kind that you can, you know, label a light switch, don't turn this off kind of thing. And so we looked around on Amazon and we found one that was reasonably priced and it looked nice. And it's like, okay, great. So we get this thing from Amazon. This is before Christmas. And I open it up, okay, from China. All right, not that big of a deal. How do you work it? Well, the way you have to work it is you have to put an app on your phone, and using the app, that's how you tell the label maker what you want on the label. So I go to the app, and most of it's in Chinese. Some of it's in English. I don't read Chinese. But my instinctive decision on the spot was, honey, we're sending this thing back. I'm not going to put an app on my phone that's based in China that may easily, in some way or another, have been caught up in this panoply of communist Chinese government surveillance. I'm not going to do it. So we just sent that nice little label maker back. I didn't download the app, and we're in the market for a label maker that doesn't involve China. So that's my take on these issues. I don't trust anything electronic from China. Oh, he's being xenophobic. No, I'm not. If you pay attention to what China's doing, it's entirely reasonable to be cautious in that regard. And all the more so, especially if it connects to the internet. Okay, what about your smart refrigerator, somebody might say, or your smart TV or your smart whatever? Well, that's a problem. I freely admit. So going forward, if I personally have the ability to screen out from, you know, candidates for appliances or something else that I want to have in my home, if I can screen it out on the basis of this comes from China and it connects to the internet, I'm going to screen it out. That's just me, because I don't want to give them even a small foothold if I can avoid doing it. 888-914-9149. How about Don now in Rhode Island? Good morning, Don.
Hi, good morning.
Yes, good morning.
Can you hear me?
You're on the air, Don.
Yes, my question is, Patrick, and thank you for your show. I'm a recent listener.
I am
from Rhode Island, and in my state, gambling is legal. I have a 26-year-old son that lives at home with me and my husband. My husband and I have been married for 33 years.
Congratulations.
My younger son has a mental illness. He is diagnosed with one, and he is currently addicted to gambling online and he, you know, smokes marijuana, and he's not supposed to.
Okay.
My overall biggest question, it's been 4 years now of us trying to help my son and find solutions through doctors, now lawyers, and just a whole mirage of people and advice. And my question to you is, my son is still living at home with my husband and I. And when he loses in gambling, which again, he gets money from the state of Rhode Island, and gambling is legal in Rhode Island. He is delusional. Mm-hmm. And my husband is like allowing all of this to go on in my home. And sometimes my son gets a little bit violent when he loses. And I'm to the point where I said, you know, I go to church every morning and I pray on it. But I said to my husband, you know, it's going to be either him or me. I don't want to allow this in my home. And we can't even find housing for him because we're in a housing crisis in Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
So, Patrick, my question to you is, today, what do I do about my husband? I don't believe in divorce either. We've been married for 33 years. My husband is just this heartbroken over this, but I feel like he's an enabler.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like it. Well, there is something called canonical separation where you can live apart. I mean, the essence of marriage, of course, is to share bed and board. You live under the same roof and you share your lives together completely. So that's the ideal state for marriage, but sometimes that's not possible, whether due to violence or mental illness or some other situation. This could be one of them, where especially if you feel that your life is in danger or, you know, that there's the possibility of violence from your son and there's no way to get your husband to fix the problem. I mean, if you had to rent an apartment a mile away or something, how sad that would be. But you have a right. As a woman, you have a right as a human being to feel safe and secure. And if you're not able to get that in your marital home, the church recognizes there are times when for your own safety and sanity, you may have to live in a different place. Doesn't mean divorce. Doesn't mean that you're walking out on the marriage, but it's known as a canonical separation. So that might be something to consider. I hate to, you know, encourage any husband or wife to do that if it's not necessary, but just keep that in your back pocket. That's something that you could, if you felt it got to that point, you could do that, you know.
Thank you. And who would I speak to about that? The priest?
Yeah, you could just, I mean, first of all, it wouldn't have to be formalized that way, but it could be. So the church's law foresees situations where this happens, and that's the term for it, a canonical separation. But you wouldn't have to necessarily formalize that with the church. You could just say, until this situation clears up, I'm going to be living in that apartment, you know, on West 5th Street across town. And let's see if we can't get this situation cleared up. And when it is, then I'll move back home. So you could do it that way, informally. Yeah. Now, of course, if your husband objects to that and says, this is alienation of affection, and I have a right to the marital bed, and she's depriving me of that. I mean, there are any number of things that if he were to say, you know, this is not right, I don't want this, then the church could, you know, formally, I don't know if the proper term here is to grant, I'm not sure what the legal term is in canon law here, but the church in a more formal way could permit a canonical separation if your husband, for example, was complaining about it. That's another dimension of the whole thing. But what about this? What about a situation where your son, who's got a substance abuse problem, what if he were to get some help at a place where both of these addictions could be conquered? And I have just such a place in mind. Now, this may not be the right place for your son, and I don't know to what extent he has serious mental problems. If he has serious mental problems, this place may not be the right place for him. But if it's mainly a matter...
He has schizoaffective disorder. It's a form. He has a serious mental illness.
Okay. Well, then this would not be the right place for him.
When I talk about church, he gets mad.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to talk about Jesus.
Yeah. I can only imagine how painful that must be for you, Dawn. So, for the benefit of those who are listening, who are saying, well, I have a similar situation. The place I was going to recommend is called the Comunità Cenacolo, which is Italian, which means the cenacle community. And their website is Hope Reborn. And they have a facility for people who have substance abuse and addiction issues, men and women. And it's a Catholic place run by Catholic folk. It's all on the up and up. So, you know, they're not, you know, sleeping in the same dorms or anything like that. It's all very properly regulated, but it's a place of miracles because young people go there and they get help, they get cleaned up, and they get cured. Countless examples of that. And so I like to recommend them, hopereborn.org. So whether it's drinking or alcohol, I'm sorry, or marijuana or something harder than that, they are experts in helping young people and even people who aren't so young. And the amazing thing about it, if you ask me, is they don't charge anything for it. So check that out. Now, in the meantime, Dawn, since that's not an option for your son, and you mentioned the housing crisis in the state, are there any state facilities in which your son could get checked in, maybe for another evaluation to see if he would qualify to live in like a group home or a setting where there will be people who could take better care of him and monitor him for problems like this? Have you looked into that?
He refuses all type of care like that. He said, I'm not going to go in a group home. He said, you should go to one. And this is how he talks to me.
Well, see, it's not his choice. If he's clinically diagnosed with a severe mental illness, that's not his choice to make. Now, it may be difficult to process that through, but if he's that seriously, you know, into mental illness, it's not his choice to make. And you and your husband should not be held hostage to this son who has these difficulties, especially if there's state or county assistance.
And the lawyers say that the doctors have to sign off on everything. Like, the doctors have all the power, so... I'm going to keep trying to get through to the doctors, I guess, but my son won't go in a group home. My husband's thinking of paying for an apartment for him.
That's another option. That's another option. Yeah. Can your son function on his own? If he can't...
Actually, my husband doesn't think he can function on his own.
Yeah. I think this situation, just from the little bit that you've told me, it sounds like there is quite a bit of complexity here. So maybe you can get in touch with the diocese. I don't know if you're in the diocese of Fall River. No, that would be Massachusetts, wouldn't it? If you're in, if you go to your diocese and see if Catholic Charities has a department or a person who can help with mental health needs, that may be a way to help break through the red tape. And they may be in a position to say, oh, talk to this physician or talk to this county office or this state office. Chances are they'll have more of a lay of the land, and that can be of benefit to you. But I wish you well in this, Don. I'm sure it's got to be very taxing on you and very tiring. And I hope that that's alleviated very soon. Thank you. Thank you. Well, that's the top of the hour, and we're about ready to start hour two on the Patrick Madrid Show. So let's continue in the same vein. I have more I want to share with you, but if you have something you want to share with me, give me a call, 888-914-9149.